It's Tuesday, April 26, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. We'll get ready because it's coming, and it's going to be coming fast and furiously. I'm speaking about the 2012 presidential election in the United States. A presidential election coming every 4 years is a major political transformation. Of course, you'll find the national media and many in the political world entirely contextualizing this as Decision 2012, as if it just comes down to Americans making a decision about a presidential candidate. Of course, it's a far larger issue than that. There are fundamental issues at stake here having to do with the role of government, with the purposes of government in the first place, with the missions of government in terms of our communities and everyday lives, with things such as the economy and taxation, employment, foreign policy, of course, is a major issue, with the United States now involved not only in two, but in three armed conflicts around the world. On the Democratic side, we pretty much know what we're going to be facing, and that is the incumbent president, Barack Obama, running for re-election. But on the Republican side, it's going to be very interesting, because at this point, relatively late in the process, we're not even sure who is and is not running. Now, we do have a few very much in view. We know that Governor Tim Pawlenty is indeed running. We know, for instance, that former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney is running. And we know, as of this morning, someone who's not running. Yesterday, Governor Haley Barbour of Mississippi announced that he would not be running for the Republican nomination for the office of President of the United States. And so the speculation is going to be reduced down to who will show up at the first major Republican presidential debate. And when will that be held? Well, quicker than you think. May the 5th in South Carolina. At least by that date, we'll have some knowledge of who's willing to stand behind a microphone and declare that he should be president of the United States and that the Republican Party should grant him the nomination. We'll see how this goes. In the meantime, it's good to get yourself prepared for the political season that is to come. One of the most important things you can do at this point is to consider which issues are of paramount importance to you as you are looking to someone for whom you would vote for president of the United States. We're not just going to be talking about two opposing parties here. We're not even going to be talking merely about two parties and two candidates that are going to be separated by a significant gulf of policy decisions and positions. We're going to be talking about some of the most fundamental questions the United States has faced since its founding as a constitutional order in the late 18th century. This is where politics is going to get most real. If you're looking at how this particular election is likely to shape up, you might have to go back to the depths of the Great Depression in the 1920s and 30s to understand what we're facing here. This is going to be very interesting, a kind of race that ought to shape up into a debate worth having. But on that count, we'll just have to see. Meanwhile, as things in the Middle East are getting more interesting by the day and more depressing on the one hand, the reality is that many people who had had such heightened expectations about change in the Middle East are beginning to wonder exactly what might be happening. Sometimes when you ask for political instability, you get more than you count on. As we've said, starting a revolution is much more difficult than either guiding or concluding one. Just consider where we are right now. Tunisia and Egypt are falling under military control. The young students who led the insurrections that produced the revolutionary changes there are now no longer central to the picture. Instead, the military is. And in both cases, the military is pretty much the same military with the same officers and the same infrastructure that was in place under the previous regimes. That's what makes the situation in Egypt all the more interesting at the very present moment. For instance, an Egyptian court has ruled that all public representations having to do with the Mubarak family are to be taken down. All the schools, bridges, roadways, and national institutions named for former President Hosni Mubarak or his wife Suzanne are to be removed by court order. Now, this is something of a form of identity cleansing. This is what happens when you topple a dictator. You immediately want to remove all references to him, and that's exactly what is going on in Egypt. But, of course, the problem is that the court that made this ruling is pretty much the same court that served the interest of Hosni Mubarak when he was in office. Just about everyone in Egypt right now is trying to be on the right side of history and on the right side of the political momentum. That may be very difficult to maintain. Meanwhile, even as the United States is now militarily involved in Libya, because, as we said through our own president, that we were becoming involved because of a concern for the massacre of civilians, even as we are now facing something like a stalemate in that country, the reality is that violence has broken out elsewhere, in this case in Syria, where the regime of Bashar Assad is now very much under the kind of threat that was present before in Tunisia and Egypt and Bahrain and, yes, in Libya. But of course, in Syria, it's a very different story. There are reports of hundreds of persons who have been killed in skirmishes with the Syrian military. And one thing we know from the experience of watching the Assad regimes in Syria in recent years, this is a country that knows through its secret police how to maintain order through whatever cost of violence is necessary. We'll be watching these situations very closely, but of course many in the world are beginning to scratch their heads and wonder, why did the United States intervene in Libya and now not in Syria? Well, the reality is that Syria is a very difficult nut to crack in terms of the international picture. For the United States, Syria has been simultaneously, on the one hand, a certain source of stability in the Middle East, on the other hand, a source of tremendous moral evil. And so what we're looking at here is a reshuffling of the cards, a change in the chess pieces, so to speak. And the reality on the ground is not exactly what we had hoped for. And quite frankly, we're not even sure now what we should hope for. Not in terms of the realpolitik of figuring out how to engage as a country with all of these different regimes and with all of the different insurgency groups within these regimes. The world is a very interesting place. We're beginning to look like the kind of anarchy that has ruled at different times in world occurrence. History reveals that times of anarchy seldom last for long. This kind of political instability is generally followed by some kind of order. On the other side of World War I, you had the rise, of course, even in the German-speaking lands, especially in Germany and later also Austria, of the Nazi regime. On the other side of World War II, you ended up with the stability of the Cold War. On the other side of this, well, it remains to see what is going to be seen. But barring some new development, there are very few indications that something inherently hopeful is likely to eventuate out of this. There's a very interesting story in the New York Times on Monday morning. It's an editorial column by Ross Douthat entitled A Case for Hell. Ross Douthat is responding to the recent book authored by Rob Bell entitled Love Wins, a book about heaven, hell, and the fate of every person who ever lived. Now, we've talked about this rather extensively. I've written an extensive review of the book. It's been a part of evangelical conversation. Rob Bell here is basically embracing a form of universalism. Ross Douthat writes, in the New York Times no less, that what is going on here is that Rob Bell is arguing that hell might not exist. Now, in reality, I have to argue that Rob Bell is actually not trying to argue that hell does not exist, but rather that the hell of the Bible doesn't exist. He suggests that there is hell on earth, and there are persons who morally will decide for that kind of hellish existence rather than for the forgiveness of God. But nonetheless, on the way to making his argument, Ross Douthat makes some very interesting assertions. He says this, in part, hell's weakening grip on the religious imagination is a consequence of growing pluralism. Bell's book begins with a provocative question. Are Christians required to believe that Gandhi is in hell for being Hindu? The Mahatma is a distinctive case, Mr. Douthat writes. But swap in my Hindu-Jewish-Buddhist neighbor for Gandhi, and you can see why many religious Americans find the idea of eternal punishment for wrong belief increasingly incredible. He goes on, but the more important factor in hell's eclipse, perhaps, is a particular paradox of modernity. As our lives have grown longer and more comfortable, our sense of outrage at human suffering, its scope, and its apparent randomness has grown sharper as well. The argument that a good deity couldn't have made a world so rife with cruelty is a staple of atheist polemic, and every natural disaster inspires a round of soul-searching over how to reconcile with God's omnipotence, or how to reconcile God's omnipotence with human anguish. He goes on to say, doing away with hell, then, is a natural way for pastors and theologians to make their God seem more humane. The problem is that this move also threatens to make human life less fully human. Now, reading Ross Douthat, well, the interesting thing is that from this point in his argument, he goes on to make almost exactly the same argument made by Rob Bell. Reading the article, one might gain the impression that Ross Douthat thinks that he's in disagreement with Mr. Bell. But in reality, the arguments end up being strangely similar. Both of these men argue that the decisive issue here is human libertarian freedom, that humans have to have the ability to exert the will, even if the will is to be in hell, and God simply has to respect that will. It's an interesting argument, not a particularly new argument, but an argument that says that the sovereignty of God is ultimately secondary to the libertarian decisions of human beings. That God himself simply cannot keep, cannot help, cannot prevent someone from going to hell if they're determined to do so. That's an interesting story. It's just not the story of the Bible. That's just not what God has revealed in his word. USA Today had a headline that is one of those that perhaps ought to be kind of frozen in time as a reminder of how frivolous Americans can be. Here's the headline on the front page, no less, of USA Today's weekend edition from last week. It reads, Film Study, Men Talk, and Women Show Skin. In this story, Nancy Helmick writes that an analysis of the 100 top-grossing movies of the year 2008 shows that men had 67% of the speaking roles, women had about half that, or 33%. So in other words, evidently someone watched all of the 100 top-grossing films of the year 2008 and using some kind of clock or measuring device determined who was speaking when and who had the speaking roles for what percentage of time. Now, the article goes on to say, at the same time, female characters were more likely to wear sexy, provocative clothing than men or to appear partially naked. Now, I read this and I have to wonder, who in the world thinks this is news? Who in the world had to commission a research project for this? And what do these numbers actually tell us? Well, they tell us pretty much that what we think we're seeing when we look at Hollywood is actually what we are seeing. Now, there's a bit of moral interest here from a non-feminist perspective that should concern all. The sexualization of teen girls, according to the report, was the most troubling finding. This was undertaken by researchers at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California. Female teenage characters were more likely to wear sexy, provocative clothing than other women, even more than those who were aged 21 to 39, and teen girls were as likely to appear partially naked as the older women. Lead researcher Stacy Smith, who is, by the way, a professor of entertainment at the University of Southern California, says, quote, the data speaks to an overemphasis on beauty, thinness, and the sexualization of women at younger and younger ages, end quote. Now, the study was to be released over the weekend. There's likely to be a good deal of conversation about this. You have women complaining that women in the films are largely eye candy, that they are treated as being less intelligent. They don't have the speaking parts. Well, one specialist came on and said, quote, women represent roughly half of the U.S. population and buy roughly half of the movie tickets, but they still represent only a third of the speaking roles in film. Stacy Smith, again at USC, said females are missing in action when it comes to speaking roles. Jennifer Stevens Aubrey, University of Missouri, said this is sending a powerful message that it's important for girls and young women to be sexual objects from a very early age, end quote. Now, my concern with this article is not that it doesn't tell us something that's morally important. My concern with this article is that it shouldn't tell us anything that we didn't already know. One of the things we need to remember is that the entertainment culture is not something that is forced upon the American people. Both liberals and conservatives are tempted to complain about the entertainment culture as if it is some kind of sinister plot that has been foisted upon us by some kind of foreign nation. That is not the case. These films, these movies, these television shows, all of these artifacts of popular culture are being produced because someone is buying them. The reality is that this is a consumer-driven market. Yes, there are those who have their own artistic contribution to make, but by and large, these films are being made, these musical packages are being distributed, all of this is being done because somebody is looking to make a profit and somebody has to buy the tickets. So all of the problems identified by these researchers are real. The sexualization in particular of young girls ought to be extremely troubling. But the reality is that the people to blame for this are not only the producers and the directors and the actors and the entire entertainment complex in Hollywood and New York. It is the American people who are buying the tickets even as they sit there eating their popcorn and complaining. That is not only a form of cultural hypocrisy, that's a form of moral delusion. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.